And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman with you, along with Joseph Cooper. Ellen Gurganus' first novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, spent 8 months on the New York Times bestseller list and sold more than 4 million copies. A 700-page epic about love and war, it established Gurganus as one of the leading Southern writers of his generation. His new book, Local Souls, also takes place below the Mason-Dixon line. It's a collection of novellas that follows the bittersweet lives of the citizens of a present-day fictional town in North Carolina, where buried secrets are unearthed like corpses in a flood. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Gurganus. He began by asking him why he dislikes the term Southern fiction.
I think it localizes the universal struggle and pinpoints it in a form of dismissal. I think it's like romantic fiction or science fiction. I'm trying to write work that will be translated into every language in the world, and happily that's happening. It's thrilling to see. So to then be categorized as related to a single region of a single country is inherently minimizing. I don't think of Faulkner as a Southern writer. I think of Faulkner as a great human writer, as a great writer. And everybody has to be from somewhere, Ariel. You know, we all start where we were born. And if we're smart, we look around and make huge advantage of what we saw when we first slithered out of the womb and learned our lessons or didn't. So I'm happy to be categorized as a Southerner, as a gay Southerner, as a crazy white man, as a lapsed Presbyterian. But I don't think any of them really speaks to who I really am as an artist.
Loco Souls is your first book in over a decade, but you weren't suffering from writer's block. You were still writing every day, right?
That's right. At this point, I'm now 66. Writing is like breathing. It's not something you have to think about doing. It's something that you do automatically. And it means for me, as the great-great-grandson of farmers, proving my worth when the rooster gets up and crows in the morning by being at my desk and hacking away with a hoe and a rake and pruning shears at my prose and trying to make something living and beautiful and lasting, and that seems true to me. So I have disappeared from publishing, but I've never disappeared from writing. And I think they're from two completely different categories. I'm a little shocked at what I find emerging like Rip Van Winkle from a long sleep about where American book culture is and how much it's declined in seriousness in the last 10 or 12 years. But for me, the great thrill of being a writer is not being recognized in the airport. It's the privilege of getting up and trying to make sense of this screwy, you know, chaotic world. And it's a kind of sorting that's essential to me for my own sanity.
We're speaking with author Ellen Gurganus, whose latest book is a story collection entitled Local Souls. Local Souls is a collection of three novellas. Your last book, The Practical Heart, was a collection of novellas too. What is it about the novella that you like?
I think it's the perfect form for the way we live now. Peter Taylor, who was a great practitioner of the form, said it is a unit that can be picked up after dinner and finished by bedtime. And I think that given our hectic schedule and how plugged into our gizmos and monitors we all willingly are, that essentially a work of novelistic depth and resonance and power that can be read in a single sitting is an amazing kind of achievement. And it just happens to coincide with the way I sort of see things. I'm very interested, in fact, obsessed with the idea of obsession. And I'm fascinated with people who give themselves over to a single issue, a single love, a single regret, a single enterprise in their lives, and stake everything on that. And in the fiction, it means that the secondary characters who were in the 19th century novel were often comical characters, often servant characters or subsidiary characters who came on to make you chuckle before the darkness starts again. I eliminate those and I try to make an arc that is unifying and that builds in velocities to a powerful end. And I want to do that in a long single sitting so that the reader, like listening to a symphony, can have the experience all at once and be my collaborator in a way in the creation of the work.
Well, all three of the novellas in Local Souls follow characters from the fictional town of Falls, North Carolina. You've written about Falls before. What type of town is it?
It's a town of 6,000 souls, and that makes it a big town in a way. The name Souls in the title is very willfully arrived at. I think a lot of people from bigger cities think little towns are filled with little people. And I'm fascinated with the ethos of the village, the compassion of the village and the savagery of the village. And as you know, from anybody who's ever grown up in a little town, a unit like that can be the most forgiving and the most fierce when it's going against somebody who's wronged one of its own. So I felt that the town needed to be historically rooted. It's founded in the 1840s. It was a cotton mill town. It was a tobacco center, and now the cotton mills have all gone to Mexico, and the tobacco has been proven to be carcinogenic. And there are these gigantic empty warehouses downtown, and people who were tobacconists who smoked and then died of lung cancer and warned their children never to smoke. It's a farm town with access to Raleigh, which makes it a kind of sophisticated village. And it's the most wonderful laboratory area. I love it. I really love it. And I know it. When I dream, I sometimes wander down streets of it I've never visited. It's not my hometown, which was Rocky Mount. It's not my current hometown, which is Hillsborough, North Carolina. But it's somewhere in between. It's somewhere between the hyperconscious, the willed, and the unconscious. And I know, having started the town with Oldest Living Confederate Widow in 1989, every avenue, every twist and turn, not only of the prosperous white section, but of Baby Africa, which is where the black citizens live. So I literally can walk in my head to a door and knock on the door and see who answers the door. And it's an amazingly fertile zone, and I recommend it to your writing readers, listeners, to invent a town and imagine it and chronicle it.
One novella in the book is called Fear Not. It opens with the narrator, a writer like yourself, attending a school musical. There he meets a charming couple, but he finds out something about them that's disturbing, maybe monstrous. He decides to investigate their past and write a story about how they got together. The narrator swears 81% of the story is true. Is he telling the truth?
I'm not sure 81.5% is absolutely accurate, but I think he genuinely believes that he has based the fiction on documentation, and there's a lot of legwork. He has to go all over the U.S. to find the information and to live online the way we all do these days. I'm not sure he could tell you which 20% he made up and which he didn't. And I think that's the artist's obligation, is to take the assigned bricks and put mortar between it in varying patterns. And that's what we do with each other. I mean, we've just met. I'm imagining you. I can picture your father and your mother and your siblings and try to make up a history for you. And that's my prerogative as a novelist, is to see people in an airport or to see people at a school play and think, how would I tell their stories, and what must have brought these two extremely unlikely but loving people together? And that became the challenge for this story. I based it in part on Henry James and in part on detective novels. I'm I'm a big fan of Jim Thompson and of Raymond Chandler. And I think James N. Came. I think a lot of people don't take them seriously enough as real artists. And I wanted to write a unit that was filled with suspense, which literally means to withhold information. A suspense novel is a withheld bit of information that's offered only at the end, and that keeps the reader panting forward at a rate that the author determines. So it was a fascinating exercise, and it's unlike anything else I've ever written, and it's much more in the third person because it has to be filled with information of the lives that I chronicle.
And what I found interesting about that story is that, again, I don't want to give anything away, but the secret of this couple, you're very compassionate about it, very, the narrator is. Others would, scream bloody murder, but you are, or the narrator's understanding. Is that what fiction does, to try to make that which people would reject automatically more understandable?
That's a great mission for fiction, and I think ideally that's what we're attempting to do. And I think the movement of the story is toward understanding. I think if you've gone through all the living accidents that these two people have withstood, that you tend to want to forgive them by understanding them.
Right. We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Alan Gurganis. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and short story writer Alan Gurganis. His new book is called Local Souls, and it's a collection of three short novels set in a small town in North Carolina. Alan, another novella in the book is called Decoy. It contains a powerful description of a flood, but this disaster is more an act of man than of God. You write, "The Department of Interior raffles off the wetlands meant to absorb our runoff rain. With Walmart parking lots paved hard, no sponginess is left. Water's got to go somewhere, so it came picking our locks. So is gentrification jeopardizing the South?"
I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that one of the things that set us apart from certain other regions is a tremendous love of the land and a deep knowledge of the land. I grew up in a generation where my grandfather had left the farm for running businesses in town, but he kept what is known as a hobby farm, which is not necessarily a fully functioning working farm, but a sentimental attachment, an umbilical connection to the land. And I was very lucky, having been born in 1947, to have access not only to our suburban house, but to my grandparents' Victorian house in the middle of the town, and 6 miles outside of town, the family farm, where we did hunting and berry picking and raised hogs and generally ran wild as children. It was marvelous. It gave me a real sense of the primacy of the land. And I don't think we've been good stewards. That's an understatement. I think we're a suicidal race in a way that we would never have expected it 20 years ago. And we're just waking up and realizing, I think, that we want to live. And even if we don't want to live, we want our children and great-grandchildren to live. And I'm hoping that we can turn the ship of state around fast enough to save the day. But I still think there's a great place for love poems to the earth itself, to mater, to land and dirt. And I've tried to do that in this novella.
Well, you once wrote a story about the difficulty of being gay in the South in the 1950s. You say that back then there was only one way of coming out. It was getting caught. You still live in North Carolina. Are people there more reasonable now?
I think a lot of people have come to terms with the issue precisely because they have a nephew who's gay, or it turns out that their husband is gay, or their son is gay, or their daughter. But the prevailing right-wing thinking that seems to be have a death grip on this culture is still in control in North Carolina, that Republicans control both the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion. And so gay marriage is completely verboten. Anybody can be fired from any job for being gay. And there's still a kind of terror associated with it, at least on the books. I think sometimes it takes legislation and religion a long, 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 long time to catch up with what common citizens are thinking. And I'd like to believe that most people are much more sympathetic than they were a couple of decades ago.
Well, some gays of your generation reacted to homophobia by becoming vehemently anti-gay. You see it with some politicians and religious leaders. I won't name names. Do you have, what are your feelings about these anti-gay gays?
I think most people who have virulent hatred of gay people are responding to something in themselves. I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan, but I don't want to lock everybody up who only eats rutabagas. I mean, what is it about vegans that would drive me to feel that I want to persecute them? I think there's something in sexual experimentation in our early youths that draws a lot of people and makes them feel very guilty about something they did with little Willie behind the barn of a given morning, and that they spend their lives, adult lives, in church on their knees and in the state capitol making laws to mitigate against what they themselves did. I think self-knowledge is the beginning of everything, and I think there's very little of it in evidence in the capitals of our country.
We're speaking with author Alan Gurganis, whose latest book is Loco Souls. Recently, I've interviewed two of your former students, Kate Christensen and Robert Antoni. They have nothing but praise for you. In her memoir, Blue Play Special, Christensen says you were her favorite teacher at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You inspired her to keep writing. How does one teach creative writing? Well, at least how do you do it?
Well, there I have to put in a plug for them. Kate Christensen and Robert Antoni are wonderful people and wonderful writers. They're amazing. And they were amazing from the time they were 18. I think listening is in very short supply in our culture. And I think one thing that a creative writing class can provide, which is an extraordinary thing and a prize above oxygen, is to sit a group of people in a room and have everybody listen to the stories that each of them tells in turn. It's an incredibly rare opportunity. And in the best writing classes, there is a whole lot of listening going on. The funny thing about listening is if you listen to other people long enough and hard enough, you begin to hear yourself. That's what education is all about. And since storytelling is inherently communal, you can't do it. You can't sit in a closet and tell stories. You've got to have an auditor. You've got to have a person who responds. And I think that's what creative writing classes at their best can offer. I get a lot of mail from people who say, congratulations, you know, I want you to be the first person to read my 500,000 word novel, and it's arriving by UPS. I've never heard of this person. I've never met them. And my suggestion to each of them, I actually have it on my website as a form of self-protection, is to find three or four people, it doesn't take more than five people altogether, who are working at your same level of experience and with your same level of talent, we hope, and read to each other and read each other alive. And make that something that you do every other week, and make that a living part of your existence and an essential part of your friendships. I don't think you have to have an institutional sanction. In a way, it may be easier to replace people as they age out or they stop being interested in the work without having to go through an administration. But we all need listeners desperately. And I was very lucky to be a listener for Kate and Robert at an early stage of their careers.
Well, you had great teachers too. Top of the list, of course, is John Cheever. He taught you at Iowa. Cheever, without doubt, is one of America's greatest short story writers. He fell out of favor for a while. Then he came back, and now, you know, he may be falling, unfortunately, falling out of favor again. What was Cheever like?
When you read the biographies, Blake Bailey's biography that was just published a couple of years ago, it's a brilliant, beautiful book. You feel that he must have been a very depressed person. He was alcoholic from an early age. He grew up in a family that had great pretensions to pretension, but had lost all its money. And the mother had to work in a gift shop, and that was a huge come down for the family. And you would think he would be a gloomy Gus, but if you've read the work, you know how joyful the work is. And his company was like that, Ariel. He was so much fun, minute to minute. He was always getting into mischief. I walked around Iowa City with him when I was, you know, 20 years old, 21, and he was 65. And he was always enlisting me in sandlot football games, to which I was not qualified. But nobody could say no to him. And I remember once he sat up in the stands at a high school football yard, and I was playing football, which I didn't play much as a child. And I went for a long one, and I caught a touchdown pass, and it was one of the happiest moments of my life. It was like all the attention that my father had never paid me, John Cheever, who is a genius of American fiction, was expressing by jumping up and down on the stands. Marvelous, he said. Absolutely marvelous. Do another one. Do another one. It was such a thrill to have such a sponsor. And I think if you've had that kind of sponsorship, the only way you can repay it is by finding other interested, talented kids and try to offer that to them.
Did he help you to develop your own voice?
He did. He was not a good teacher in the sense that he could look at a sentence and say, you see why this one works and this one is less good. It was all yes or no with John, and that's sort of how he wrote himself. He would write a whole story in the morning, and if he read it in the afternoon and it was no good, he would throw the whole story out. There was no real revision. He was supporting his wife and three kids and all the orthodontia and boarding schools that required, and a story worked or not, but most of the stories worked magnificently, and that's one of the things he taught me.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Alan Gurganis.